Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Mardell, reading The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith. Chapter 17. Satan did not sleep well. It was too hot. He was glad after 8 hours to get up. No sooner had he started to shave, however, than one of the slaves touched his arm, motioning him into a reclining chair and showing him a keen blade, long and slightly curved. Satan lay down, and the slave shaved him with a rapidity and smoothness he had never before experienced, so wonderfully sharp was the peculiar razor. Then the barber began to shave his superior, with no preliminary treatment save rubbing his face with a perfumed oil. "Hold on a minute," said Seaton. "Here's something that helps a lot, soap." He lathered the face with his brush, and the man with the belt looked up in surprised pleasure as his stiff beard was swept away with no pulling at all. Seaton called to the others, and soon the party was assembled in his room. All were dressed very lightly because of the unrelieved and unvarying heat, which was constant at 100 degrees. A gong sounded, and one of the slaves opened the door, ushering in servants bearing a table ready set. The earthlings did not eat anything, deciding that they would rather wait an hour or so and then eat in the Skylark. Hence the slaves had a much better meal than they otherwise would have had. During that meal, Seaton was very much surprised at hearing Dorothy carrying on a labored conversation with one of the women. "I knew you were a language shark, Dottie, but I didn't suppose you could pick up one in a day." "Oh, I can't. Just a few words. I can understand very little of what they're trying to tell me." The woman spoke rapidly to the man with the belt, who immediately asked Seaton's permission to speak to Dorothy. Running across to her, he bowed and poured out such a stream of words that she held up her hand to silence him. "Go slower, please," she said, and added a couple of words in his own language. There ensued a very strange conversation between the slave couple and Dorothy, with much talking between the man and the woman, both talking at once to Dorothy, and much use of signs and sketches. Dorothy finally turned to Seaton with a frown.
"I can't make out half of what he tried to tell me, and I'm guessing at part of that. He wants you to take him somewhere, another room of the palace here, I think. He wants to get something. Now, I can't quite make out what it is, or whether it was his and they took it away from him, or whether it's something of theirs that he wants to steal. He can't go alone. Martin was right. Any of them will be shot if they stir without us. And he says, I'm pretty sure of this part, when you get there, don't let any guards come inside."
"What do you think, Mart? I'm inclined to string along with this bunch. At least part way. I don't like Nal Boone's honor guard set up a bit. It smells like overripe fish."
Crane concurred. Seaton and his slave started for the door. Dorothy went along.
"Better stay back, Dottie. We won't be gone long."
"I will not go back," she said for his ears alone. "On this damn world, I'm not going to be away from you 1 minute more than I absolutely have to."
"Okay, Ace," he replied in the same tone. "You'd be amazed to find out how little there is in that idea for me to squawk about."
Preceded by the man with the belt, and followed by half a dozen other slaves, they went out into the hall. No opposition was made by their going, but half a company of armed guards fell in with them as an escort, most of them looking at Seaton with a mixture of reverence and fear. The slave led the way to a room in a distant wing of the palace and opened the door. As Seaton stepped into it, he saw that it was an audience chamber or courtroom and that it was now empty. The guards approached the door. Seaton waved them back. All retreated across the hall except the officer in charge, who refused to move. Seaton, the personification of offended dignity, stared haughtily at the offender,
who returned the stare with interest and stepped forward, fully intending to be the first to enter the room. Seaton, with a flat of his right hand on the officer's chest, pushed him back roughly, forgetting that his strength, great upon earth, would be gigantic upon this smaller world. The officer spun across the corridor, knocking down three of his men in his flight. Picking himself up, he drew his sword and rushed, while his men fled in panic to the extreme end of the corridor. Seaton did not wait for him, but leaped to meet him. With his vastly superior agility, he dodged the falling broadsword, drove his right fist into the fellow's throat, with all the strength of arm and shoulder and all the momentum of his body behind the blow. Bones broke audibly as the officer's head snapped back. The body went high in the air, turned two complete somersaults, crashed against the far wall, and dropped to the floor. At this outrage, some of the guards started to lift their peculiar guns. Dorothy screamed a warning. Seaton drew and fired in one incredibly fast motion. The Mark I load obliterated the clustered soldiers and demolishing that end of the palace. In the meantime, the slave had taken several pieces of apparatus from a cabinet and had placed them in his belt, stopping only to observe for a few moments a small instrument, which he clamped to the head of the dead man. He led the party back to the room they had left, and set to work upon the device he had built. During the sleeping period, he connected it in an extremely intricate network of wiring with the pieces of apparatus he had just obtained. "Whatever that is, it's a nice job," Duquesne said admiringly. "I've built complex stuff myself, but he's got me completely lost. It'd take a week to find out where some of the stuff is going and what it's going to do when it gets there." Straightening up, the slave clamped several electrodes to his head and motioned to Seaton and the others, speaking to Dorothy as he did so.
"He wants to put those things on our heads," she translated, "but I can't make out what they're for. Shall we let him?"
"Yes," he decided instantly. "There's going to be hell to pay any minute now, and no pitch hot. I got us in too deep to back out now. Besides, I've got a hunch. But of course, I'm not trying to decide for any of you. In fact, Dot, it might be smart if you..."
"I'm not smart, Dick. Where you go, I go," Dorothy said quietly, and bent her auburn head to be fitted.
"I do not relish the idea," Crane said. "In fact, I do not like it at all. But under present circumstances, it seems the thing to do." Margaret followed Crane's lead, but Duquesne said with a sneer, "Go ahead, let him make zombies of you. Nobody wires me up to a machine I can't understand."
The slave closed a switch, and instantly the four visitors acquired a completely detailed knowledge of the languages and customs of both Mardonale, the nation in which they now were, and of Condal, the nation to which the slaves belonged, the only two civilized nations upon Osnome. While amazement at this method of instruction was still upon the Earthmen's faces, the slave, or as they now knew him, Dunark, the Kofedix, or Crown Prince of Condal, began to remove the helmets. He took off the girls and Crane's. He was reaching for Seaton's when there was a flash, a crackle, and a puff of smoke from the machine. Dunark and Seaton both fell flat. Before Crane could reach them, however, they both recovered, and Dunark said, "This is a mechanical educator, something entirely new. We've been working on it several years, but it is still very crude. I didn't like to use it, but I had to warn you of what Nalboon is going to do, and to convince you that saving your own lives would save ours as well. But something went wrong, probably because of my hasty work in assembly. Instead of stopping at teaching you our languages, it shorted me and Dick together completely."
"What would such a short do?" Crane asked. "I'll answer that, Dunark." Seaton had not recovered quite as fast as the Condalian, but was now back to normal. "All it did was print in the brain of each of us, down to the finest detail, everything that the other had ever learned. It was the completeness of the transfer, that put us both out for a minute. I'm sorry, Seton, believe me. Why, Seton grinned, it's taken each of us all of our lives to learn what we know. Now it's doubled. We're both way ahead, aren't we? I certainly am, and I'm very glad that you take it that way, but time presses. Let me tell him, Seton said. You aren't exactly sure which English to use yet, the one I talk or the one I write, and neither you nor we can think very fast yet in the other's language. I'll boil it down. This is Crown Prince Dunark of Condal. The other 13 are relatives of his, princes and princesses. Nalboon's raiders got them while they were out hunting, using a new kind of nerve gas so they couldn't kill themselves, which is a good technique in these parts. Condal and Martindale have been at war for over 6,000 years, a war with no holds barred. No prisoners except to find out what they know, no niceties. Having found out what these Condalians knew, Nalboon threw a party, a Roman circus really, and was going to feed them to some pet devilfish of his, when those armored flying animals, Carlano they call them, smelled them and came into the picture. You know what happened then. These people were aboard Nalboon's plane, the one we eased down to the ground. You'd think Nalboon would think he owed us something, but... Let me finish. Dunark cut in. You simply will not do yourself justice. Having saved his life, you should have been guests of the most honored kind. You would have been anywhere else in the universe. But no Martindalian has or ever has had either honor or conscience. At first, Nalboon was afraid of you, as we all were. We thought you were from the 15th sun, now at its closest possible distance. And after seeing your power, we expected annihilation. However, after seeing the Skylark as a machine, learning that you were short of power, and finding you gentle, weak, he thinks, that is, how wrong he is, instead of bloodthirsty, Nalboon decided to kill you and take your ship with its wonderful new power. For while we Osnomians are ignorant of chemistry, we know machines and we know electricity. No Osnomian has ever had any inkling that such a thing as atomic energy exists. Nevertheless, after his study of your engines, Nalboon knows how to liberate it and how to control it. With the Skylark, he could obliterate Condal, and to do that, he would do anything. Also, he, or any other Osnomian scientist, including myself, would go to any length, would challenge First Cause itself to secure even one of those small containers of the chemical you call salt. It is the scarcest, most precious substance in our world. You actually had more of it at the table than the total previously known to exist upon all Osnome. Its immense value is due not to its rarity, but to the fact that it is the only known catalyst for our hardest metals. You now know why Nalboon intends to kill you, and nothing you can do or not do will alter that intent. His plan is this. During the next sleeping period, I simply can't use your word night, there is no such thing on Osnome. He will cut into the Skylark and take all the salt you have in it. The interrupted circus will be resumed with you Tellurians as principal guests. We Condalians will be given to the Carlono. Then you five will be killed and your bodies smelted to recover the salt that is in them. This is the warning I had to give you. Its urgency explains why I used my crude educator. In self-defense, I must add this. The lives of you five Tellurians are not of paramount importance. The lives of us 14 Condalians, much less so. We are all expendable. The Skylark, however, is not. If Nalboon gets her, every living Condalian will die within a year. That fact and that fact alone explains why you saw me, the Kofedix of Condal, prostrate myself before Nalboon of Martindale, and heard me order my kinsmen to do the same. How do you, prince of another nation, know all these things? Crane asked. Some are common knowledge. I heard much while aboard Nalboon's plane. I read Nalboon's plan from the brain of the officer Dick killed. He was a colonel of the guard and high in Nalboon's favor. He was to have been in charge of cutting into the Skylark and of killing and smelting you five.
Well, that clears things up, Seaton said. Thanks, Dunark. The big question now is, what do we do about it?
I suggest that you take us into the Skylark and get away from here as soon as you can. I'll pilot you to Condalec, our capital city. There, I can assure you, you will be welcomed as you deserve. My father will treat you as a visiting Carfidix should be treated. As far as I am concerned, if you can succeed in getting us back to Condal, or in getting the Skylark there without any of us, nothing I can ever do will lighten the burden of my indebtedness, but I promise you all the copper you want, and anything else you may desire that is within the power of all Condal to give.
Seaton scowled in thought.
Our best chance is with you, he said finally, but if we give you atomic power, which we would be doing if we take you back home, Condal will obliterate Mardenale, if you can.
Of course.
So, ethically, perhaps we should leave you all here and try to blast our own way to the Skylark, then go on about our own business.
That is your right.
But I couldn't do it, and if I did, Dottie would skin me alive and rub salt in every day from now on. And Nalboon and his crowd are the scum of the universe. Maybe I'm prejudiced by having your whole mind in mine, but I think I'd have to come to the same decision if I had Nalboon's whole mind in there as well.
When will we make the break? The hour after the second meal?
The strolling hour. Yes. You are using my knowledge, I see. Just as I am using yours.
Mart and Duquesne will make our break just after the next meal, when everybody is strolling around talking to everybody else. That's when the guards are most lax, and our best chance, since we haven't got any armor and no good way of getting any.
But how about your killing his guards and blowing the end out of his palace? Duquesne asked. He isn't the type to take much of that sitting down. Won't that make him hurry things along?
We don't quite know, either Dunark or I. It depends pretty much on which emotion is governing, anger or fear. But we'll know pretty quick. He'll be paying us a call of state pretty soon now. We'll see what he acts like and how he talks. However, he's quite a diplomat and may conceal his real feelings entirely. But remember, he thinks gentleness is fear. So don't be surprised if I open up on him. If he gets the least bit tough, I'll cut him down to size right then.
Well, Crane said, if we have some time to wait, we may as well wait in comfort instead of standing up in the middle of the room. I, for one, would like to ask a few questions.
The Tellurians seated themselves upon divans, and Dunark began to dismantle the machine he had built. The Condalians remained standing behind their masters until Seaton protested. "Please sit down, everybody. There's no need of keeping up this farce of your being slaves as long as we're alone."
"Perhaps not, but at the first sign of a visitor, we must all be in our places. Now that we have a little time and are able to understand each other, I will introduce my party to yours. Fellow Condalians, greet Carfidix Seaton and Carfidix Crane of strange and extremely distant planet called Earth."
He and his group saluted formally.
"Greet also the noble ladies, Miss Vanaman and Miss Spencer, soon to become Carfidir Seaton and Carfidir Crane, respectively."
They saluted again.
"Guests from Earth, allow me to present the Kofidir Sitar, the only one of my wives, who was unfortunate enough to be with me on our ill-fated hunting expedition."
One of the women stepped forward and bowed deeply to the four, who returned the compliment in kind. Ignoring Duquesne as a captive, he went on to introduce the other Condalians as his brothers, sisters, half-brothers, half-sisters, and cousins, all members of the ruling house of Condal.
Now, after I have had a word with you in private, Dr. Seaton, I will be glad to give the others any information I can.
I want a word with you too, Junior. I didn't want to break up your ceremony by arguing about it out there, but I am not, never was, and never will be a Carfidix, which word, as you know, translates quite closely into emperor. Oh, I'm merely a plain citizen.
I know that. That is, I know it in a way from your own knowledge, but I find it impossible to understand it or to relate it to anything in my own experience, nor can I understand your government. I fail entirely to see how it could function for even one of your years without breaking down. On Osnome, Dick, men of your attainments and Martin's are Carfado. You will be, whether you want to or not. Ph.D., Doctor of Philosophy, Carfidix of Knowledge.
Ah, pipe down, Dunark, forget it. What was it you wanted to talk to me about away from the mob?
Dorothy and Margaret, you already have it in your mind somewhere from mine, but you might find it as impossible to understand as I do much of yours. Your women are so different from ours, so startlingly beautiful, that Nal Boone will not kill either of them for a time. So if worst comes to worst, be sure to kill them both, while you still can.
I see. Yes, I find it now. Seton's voice was cold, his eyes hard. Thanks. I'll remember that and charge it to Nell Boone's personal account.
Rejoining the others, they found Dorothy and Sitar deep in conversation.
So a man has half a dozen or so wives? Dorothy was asking in surprise. How can you get along? Why, I'd fight like a wildcat if Dick got any such funny ideas as that.
Why, splendidly, of course. I wouldn't think of ever marrying a man if he was such a louse that only one woman would have him.
I've got a cheerful thought for you and Peg, Red Top. Dunark here thinks you two are beautiful. Startlingly beautiful, was the exact description.
What? In this light? Green, black, yellow, and mud color? Oh, we're positively hideous, if that's your idea of a joke.
Oh, no, Dorothy, Sitar interposed. You two are beautiful, really lovely, and you have such a rich, smoothly blending color flow. Why, it's a shame to hide so much of it with robes.
Yes. Why do you? Dunark asked as both girls blushed hotly. He paused, obviously searching in Dick's mind for an answer he could not find in his own. I mean, I see the sense of covering as a protection, or for certain ceremonials in which covering is ritual. But when not needed, in fact, when you were too warm, as you are now.
He broke off in embarrassment and went on.
Help, Dick, I seem to be getting my foot in it deeper and deeper. What have I done to offend?
Nothing. It isn't you at all. It's just that our race has worn clothing for centuries and can't.
Mart, how would you explain modesty to a race like that?
He swept his arm to cover the group of perfectly poised, completely unselfconscious, naked men and women.
Oh, I could explain it after a fashion, but I doubt very much if even you, Dunark, with your heredity, could understand it. Sometime, when we have a few hours to spare, I will try to, if you like. But in the meantime, what are those collars, and what do they mean?
Identifications. When a child is nearly grown, it is cast about his neck. It bears his name, national number, and the device of his house. Being made of Aranac, it cannot be altered without killing the person. Any Osnomian not wearing a collar is unthinkable. But if it should ever happen, he would be killed.
Is that belt something similar?
No, merely a pouch. But even Nal Boone thought it was opaque Aranac, so didn't try to open it.
Is that transparent armor made of the same thing?
Yes, except that nothing is added to the matrix to make it colored or opaque. It is in the preparation of this metal that salt is indispensable. It acts only as a catalyst, being recovered afterward, but neither nation has ever had enough salt to make all the armor they want.
Aren't those monsters? Carlono, I think you called them. Covered with the same thing, and what are they, anyway? Dorothy asked.
Yes, I thought that the beasts grow it just as fishes grow scales, but no one knows how they do it, or even how they can possibly do it. Very little is known about them, however, except that they are the worst scourge of Osnome. Various scientists have described the Carlon as a bird, a beast, a fish, and a vegetable, sexual, asexual, and a hermaphroditic. Its habitat is... The gong sounded, and the Condalians leaped to their positions. The Kofedics went to the door. Nalboon brushed him aside and entered, escorted by a squad of heavily armed, full-armored soldiers. A scowl of anger was on his face. He was plainly in an ugly mood.
"Stop, Nalboon of Mardonale!"
Sedan thundered, in the Mardonalian tongue, at the top of his powerful voice. "Dare you invade privacy without invitation?" The escort shrank back, but the Emperor stood his ground, although he was plainly taken by surprise. With a heroic effort, he smoothed his face into lines of cordiality.
"May I inquire why my guards are slain and my palace destroyed by my honored guest? You may, I permit it, to point out your errors. Your guards, at your order, no doubt, sought to invade my privacy. Being forbearing, I warned them once, but one of them was foolhardy enough to challenge me, and was, of course, destroyed. Then the others attempted to raise their childish weapons against me, and I, of course, destroyed them. The wall merely chanced to be inside the field of action of the force I chanced to be employing at the time."
"An honored guest? Bah! No, Nalboon, and when you seek to treat as captive a visiting domac of my race, you lose not only your own life, but the lives of all your nation as well. Do you perceive your errors?"
Anger and fear fought for supremacy on Nalboon's face, but a third emotion, wonder, won. He, Nalboon, was armed. He had with him a score of armed and armored men. The stranger had nothing. The slaves were less than nothing. Yet he stood there, arrogantly confident, master of the planet, the solar system, and the universe, by his bearing. And how? How had he completely obliterated 50 armed and armored men, and 1,000 tons of stone and ultra-hard metal? Nalboon temporized.
"May I ask how you, so recently ignorant, know our language? You may not. You may go."
Please join me next time for another exciting chapter in The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith, here on Astounding Stories of Space and Time. Until then, watch the skies. Thank you.